for the local music show.
There's a bright golden haze on the meadow. There's a bright golden haze on the meadow. The corn is as high as an elephant's eye, and it looks like it's climbing clear up to the sky. Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day. I got a beautiful feeling. Everything's going my way.
Good afternoon. It's a beautiful afternoon. You've got WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel. And today on Living Writers, I'm so happy to have Mason Stokes joining us via phone. Mason, thanks so much for being here today.
It's such a pleasure to be here. I'm very happy to be a living writer.
That's right.
It's much better than the alternative, right?
It's true. It's true. Although maybe one day we'll have a seance. Who knows? Who knows? I mean, I'll let you know if you want to be part of it.
Thank you.
I mean, in as one of the living representatives, you know. But
sure.
We are here today with your novel on the table with us, or on the table here with me. And you, where are you speaking from today, Mason?
Saratoga Springs, New York, which is upstate New York, just a little north of Albany.
And you're at Skidmore College.
That's right. I've been a professor at Skidmore College for, I think, 28 years now, which seems impossible to imagine, but apparently that's what's happened.
I mean, completely. I completely understand. And the book today that we'll be talking about is your latest, The Truth I Can All the Truth I Can Stand, out with Calkins Creek Press, which is an imprint of Astra Publishing, for young readers. All the Truth I Can Stand. This is your debut for young adult novels.
That's right.
But
yeah, I've published one novel before this, but this is my first young adult novel.
And can you, before we get too far away from it, Mason, could you talk about why you chose the Oklahoma, the song from Oklahoma, to start
us
off?
So that's the first song from Oklahoma, the film version. That's Gordon McRae from 1955. And there's a subplot in the novel that involves my characters participating in a university production of Oklahoma. And the first scene actually sort of involves my character meeting his love interest as that character is playing the lead in Oklahoma. So it became a sort of running piece of the story, just hovering beneath above the surface. But it's also, I just think, one of those great classic sort of Hollywood songs, full of hope and optimism. And then you sort of realize that underneath that hope and optimism, there might be some grittier things going on.
Completely, which is so important when we're thinking about what the novel, the story that you're telling in All the Truth I Can Stand, because that's sort of what you're going to be, that's what the novel is going to be exploring, things that aren't necessarily what they've seemed on the surface, and that life is, there's so much complexity to each human being.
Absolutely. Right. I mean, this is a novel that is based on the murder of Matthew Shepard in October of 1998 in Laramie, Wyoming. Your listeners might remember Shepard was a young gay man who was brutally murdered in what seemed at the time to be a clear-cut hate crime, someone who was murdered for being gay. Later research, later investigative journalism told us a slightly more complicated, in fact, more than slightly, a more complicated story of that. And that became, in some ways, the crux of the novel. What happens when the story you've inherited, the story that has meant so much to you, actually gets displaced or unsettled by a kind of grittier truth? And I put my characters in a situation where they have to wrestle with that question. What do you do with information you wish you didn't have?
And is this something, Mason, that that you've also been, like, a story that you, that wouldn't let you go once you also, because you, in the back of the book you have an author's note, which I think is such an interesting and important part of this novel, and such a generous thing to include as well as the writer. And you mention that when you back this, you mentioned it was 1998, and that you also had a friend named James who, when you heard about Matthew Shepard's murder, you thought of him, like your mind and your heart went back to this friend of yours from your own past. And then I can only imagine that that would be something that then also would be transformed, because that the nation had a story and a movement built around Matthew Shepard and James Byrd Jr. as well.
Right.
But in a very different way, it seems. But then you said again, like, we have this investigative journalism that revealed more of the story. Later on.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you know, as a gay man, that the murder of Matthew Shepard in '98 hit me really hard. As it did a lot of the community, right? I mean, I didn't know him, but I've never met him, of course, never even been to Wyoming, but I felt this sort of kinship, this sort of affinity, a shared sense of vulnerability, of public fragility, of a gay man being picked up in a bar and beaten senseless, seemingly because he was gay. So that's a story that hit me hard at the time, especially since, as you mentioned, Shepard, in terms of sort of image and demeanor, reminded me of someone I'd been involved with as a very closeted gay man in my first semester of college. Someone I ended up not treating well because I wasn't comfortable with myself, and I sort of fled. And so the story of Shepard, you know, I did what a lot of people did, which was I put my own sort of imprimatur on it. I projected onto that story sort of my own sense of what it felt like to be a gay man in the world and what it felt like to be vulnerable. And, you know, in doing that, it's pretty easy to erase the person himself, right, to make the story more about us than about him. And that's what I think happened nationwide in October 98, when Matthew Shepard became the symbol for a certain kind of gay rights movement, became the face of advocacy for hate crimes legislation. He put a very friendly and sort of non-threatening face on the gay community in a way that allowed us some purchase on America's attention for a while. And so we needed that story at the time, the innocent man beaten for homophobic reasons. But as I mentioned, this the investigation that followed some years later, particularly a book called The Book of Matt by Stephen Jimenez, Investigative Journalism.
Such a great title, too, just to say, The Book of Matt. It makes it epic. It makes it biblical.
It does, right? And there was so much about this story that was already biblical, mm-hmm. as Shepard was becoming an almost sort of like deified kind of Christ-like figure whose suffering was on our own behalf, right? And so it played to all sorts of American needs, including the gay community. But what Jimenez found through hundreds of hours of investigation and access to papers and documents that weren't available in '98 was that it might be more useful to think about what happened to Shepard not as a homophobic hate crime, but as something that happened at the center of the methamphetamine trade, which was coursing through Colorado, Wyoming at the time.
Yes.
It turns out Shepard himself was a meth user, also involved in dealing meth. The original story was that he didn't know his attackers, but it turned out he had had a sexual relationship with at least one of them, which involved the trade of sex for drugs. All of this complicated that sort of a clear-cut story that so many of us had assimilated and needed. And for me, it was unsettling, right? But it raised all sorts of questions about how do we remember the past? What responsibilities do we have to the past, to ourselves, to Matthew Shepard? And so the novel becomes less about this new information and more about what do you do with it once you have it? And that's the problem I gave my characters, because it was my problem too.
Right.
In some way. I almost didn't want to know what I knew now.
And so, for Mason, for this then, is that why you felt compelled to write this story? Because it is, it's researched, it's well researched, and the sources are clearly noted and acknowledged in the back of the book. But it's a work of imaginative, like speculative historical fiction as well, because you have three characters that are completely your own. One of them being the main character, Ash, and very central character, Jenna, other characters as well. So is this something like a story that you felt like it didn't let you go? So you wanted to try to figure it out using the genre of the novel?
Yeah, that's a really good question because, you know, I'm trained as a scholarly writer. I'd never really thought for most of my life that I would write fiction. I didn't think that was my skill set. I'm a scholar of African-American literature, and that's the kind of writing I had done. But I began, you know, playing with fiction a little bit later in my life after tenure. If tenure gets you anything, it should get you the freedom to write whatever you want to write. And so I took that freedom and really enjoyed it and wrote a novel or two that didn't get published and then one that did. And then when I came to this material, it did seem to me that since the story was so much about people not really knowing the truth of a central character, that not knowing would become a part of the story. And it seems to me that fiction is a place where it's perhaps easiest to play that out, right? If nonfiction is in some way a way of knowing with some degree of certainty, fiction is a way of imagining the cracks and crevices left in what's been left out of history. And it just struck me as the right genre for a meditation on these issues. The drug use in the queer community, first love. My character falls in love with the Shepherd character, whose name is Shane in the novel. It just felt a way for me to let myself take artistic license. And as you put it, I consider myself writing speculative historical fiction, which feels a little oxymoronic, right? Historical is supposed to be true. Speculative is made up. And yet at the same time, you know, all history is a collision of various stories fighting for some sort of prominence. And it seemed to me, again, that my job here was to stay as close as I could to the historical record as I knew it, and yet give myself permission to fill in the gaps and spaces left around that record in order to find perhaps a truer version of what happened, even if the imagination is a part of that truth.
Yeah, imagining your way into a certain kind of knowing.
Right. Absolutely.
And so how did you give yourself permission to do that? Did you just start writing, or did Ash come to you as a character?
Yeah, sort of. That's a good question. I hate to make this sound sort of romantic and musey, but it almost was. I sort of, once I knew the structure of the book, and the structure of the book is there's a before and an after, and the pivot of that is the murder of the Shepherd character, Shane. So once I had before and after, I knew I needed a first-person narrator who was sort of innocent to this world and to this space. Ash is a closeted young gay man living in a conservative Wyoming town, struggling with the recent loss of his mother, trying to survive this conservative space. And, you know, when he meets Shane, his world is transformed. And I needed that kind of innocence and that kind of transformation. But I also needed someone whose world was blown apart by Shane's murder. And so what came to me first was the voice, really, of the prologue, which is Ash's first-person sort of retrospective voice recounting the moment of Shane's murder. And once I had that voice and I had the structure, I sort of knew my way around it. I knew I needed another character, Jenna, who is more experienced than Ash, is a college journalist, a little hard-nosed. And Ash and Jenna together seemed to me the right team for both investigating and trying to survive what they know about this person that they loved.
Let's take a short break now, and we'll come back, and maybe you'd like to read the prologue then.
I'd be happy to.
Okay, that sounds wonderful. Today on Living Writers, Mason Stokes joins us via phone from Saratoga Springs. All the truth I can stand. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Jason behind the glass, and we'll be back. Welcome back to Living Writers. If you're just tuning in, I'm so glad you did. Today on the program, Mason Stokes joins us via phone from Saratoga Springs. His novel, All the Truth I Can Stand, out with Calkins Creek Press. Mason, thanks for choosing the songs for today's show again. Do you want to say why you chose that one?
Sure. Yeah. That is, that's Brian Eno's first track from Music for Airports, 1978. You know, an album that sort of began to define what we now know to be ambient music. And for me as a writer, Spotify will tell you that at the end of the year, Eno is at the top of my listen to list because I tend to write to Brian Eno. Not because I find him a sort of vacuous background noise, but because there's something both backgroundy and urgent about what he's doing on that record, and it's just the right space for me to have a little bit of sound in the background that keeps me a little lit up, even if it's not too distracting. I would not want to accuse Brian Eno of being background music. He's not that for me. He's a kind of enlivening background music for me.
It is so alive. It was so beautiful. I was struck by it. It was hard to ask Jason to bring it back down because it's alive in a way that isn't, it's mesmerizing in a way that makes you sharper somehow. So I love to hear that you write with this in that space. What a tribute. I'm so glad. I was like, would you like to talk about that one? Before we go any further, Mason, I'll read your short bio in the back of All the Truth I Can Stand. We've covered a lot of it because it's brief, but we're going to get to talk more with you to hear more about your story as well as the story of this novel. But here we go with a short bio. Mason Stokes is a professor of English at Skidmore College in Saratoga Springs, New York, where he teaches African American literature and queer fiction. In addition to his scholarly writing, Stokes is the author of the adult novel Saving Julian and the personal essay Namesake, which was selected for inclusion in the 2016 edition of Best American Essays. All the Truth I Can Stand is his young adult debut. For more information, visit masonstokes.com. Mason, before you, I really am looking forward to hearing you read, so we could hear some of the prose aloud together. But before we do that, it's interesting to me that even in the bio, it's noting like there was an adult novel. That's the language of it, Saving Julian. And then on All the Truth I Can Stand, it's got the imprint, Calkins Creek, an imprint of Astra Books for young readers. And I wonder what you think about that, because I feel like it's a book for everyone. And I think it's important for... it seems like maybe it could be especially important for folks in high school and college to read this potentially. But I wanted to know what you thought about that. Was that what you were thinking when you were writing it? Was this your audience? And because there's murder, right? We've already clearly talked about a hate crime that is a murder. But there's so much more abuse and trauma, as well as we've already talked about the meth use and drugs.
Right.
What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's a really complicated question because in some sense these categories are so arbitrary, right? So Saving Julian is described as an adult novel. I've had people tell me it reads like it could be a young adult. And All the Truth I Can Stand is a young adult novel that people have told me should be read by adults. And so it's, you know, these are in some sense arbitrary decisions about the publishing world. But I did write this exclusively, not exclusively for, of course, but with the intention of reaching a young adult audience.
Oh, good.
A part of my draw toward the genre is there's something activating as a writer about knowing a specific sense of who you're trying to write for. And if I imagine that I'm writing for, kids that are 14 and up, and then whatever adult finds it. And that helps me to know what I'm doing, actually. You know, we can't write without the audience in mind. And I really wanted to reach kids who might be struggling with the kind of issues that my characters are struggling with. You know, I grew up in South Carolina in the 1970s and 80s without any visible role models of what it meant to be a sort of healthy gay man in the world. I didn't find those role models until I started reading gay fiction. And I really did find in gay fiction a kind of strategy for survival. And so I think young adult fiction these days occupies that kind of urgent space for kids dealing with all sorts of stuff, whether it be gender identity or sexual orientation or drug use or loss. You know, in the past 10 years, young adult fiction has become a much grittier genre.
Yes.
In part thanks to books like The Love You Give by The Hate You Give, I'm sorry, by Angie Thomas. So it's a space where we get to deal with these difficult emotions and realities because our readers are dealing with them. And, you know, our readers know when they're being protected or condescended to. And so their lives are messy. These books are messy. I think it's a good fit. But I love the fact that there might be teenagers reading this book. I had the great pleasure of visiting a high school just last week where I had about 50 kids, most of whom had read the book. And it was really gratifying to see that that they got it and that they were both moved by it but learned some things and were helped to figure out some things. And that's really a goal of what I'm doing here.
When you are, like, when you have readers, Mason, what, like, who is reading it when, you know how sometimes you have trusted readers of different things that you're writing. Did you have any younger readers that would give you feedback on it or as you were revising? Or was it kind of once you had it published, once it was placed with this particular publisher and then you went to the school, you got to see more?
One of the great ironies of publishing young adult fiction is that all the gatekeepers are adults, right? my editor, my publisher, my publicist, all of these folks are, you know, grown people who specialize in knowing what young adults want to read. But I didn't have any actual young adults reading my book as I was writing it. What I had instead was my editor, Thalia Leaf at Calkins Creek, who is brilliantly attuned toward what young adults need, want, can handle. And so I just trusted Thalia 100% to sort of guide me through those shoals, because I got to be honest, you know, I have a niece and a nephew, both of whom are adults now, but I've known children in the past, never had any of my own. I wouldn't say I'm an expert on 14-year-olds. I'm pretty good with 18 to 22 because I'm a college professor.
Right.
Right. But it's a little nerve-wracking trying to imagine that I know what a 14-year-old is going to want to read or be able to read. And that's why I just need the help of a good publishing team who specializes in knowing that.
Mason, would you mind reading?
Yeah, happy to. Would you like just the prologue or also a little bit of chapter one? What would you like here?
That sounds great. Like,
okay.
Yep.
Yeah, no, so this is a very short prologue, and then I'll read just a couple of short pages from chapter one. But this is the way the novel begins, and it begins a first-person narrator in the voice of my narrator, Ash. They took his shoes. Not that they needed to, since he wasn't going anywhere, what with his hands tied behind his back. His head was caved in several inches. His face was covered with blood, the only clean spots, the tracks made by his tears. When they found him, the cop thought he was 13, not the 19 he really was. He was that small. I wasn't even there, but I can't stop seeing it, the butt of that pistol coming down again and again on his beautiful face. But here's the thing. Those people who think they know what happened, they have no idea. And this is chapter one. The first time I saw him, he was riding a big fake horse. I was mostly interested in the horse. It was for the university's production of Oklahoma, and my dad had got me on the stage crew. He was looking for a way to get me out of my bedroom, back into the world, as he put it. He wasn't wrong. I was spending a lot of time in my bedroom. It was the only place where I could just be. You know, not have to pretend that everything was okay when it wasn't. I helped make the horse. It looked good. Fake, but in an obvious way, like you were supposed to know it was fake. I didn't notice the guy on the horse until he started singing. It was the first song from the show, the one where the male lead, Curly, is singing about what a beautiful morning it is, how the meadow shimmers in the early light, and the corn is as tall as the sky. His voice, light and soaring, like a swallow, pulled my attention from the horse to him. He was wearing blue jeans and a plaid shirt with a bolo tie around his neck. His hat was at least a couple of sizes too big, and he kept pushing it up so he could see where he was going. He finally got frustrated with the hat and threw it into the fake corn, stage right. And it was only then that I could see his face. It was small, like the rest of him, but there was something in his eyes that was big. Like he had something inside of him that was bigger than he was. His hair was dirty blonde, and it glimmered in the stage lights. I guess people would have called him cute, which was going to be a problem for the production, since cowboys aren't really supposed to be cute. I imagine rugged is more what you're going for with a cowboy, and this kid was far from rugged. But there he was, as Curly, riding his fake horse, singing about how everything was going his way. His 100-watt smile made you want to believe that there was nothing out there on the shimmering meadow but beauty and goodness and possibility. But there was something in his voice that made you doubt the smile, if only for a second. Just a hitch, maybe, the tiniest crack. But it was enough to suggest that he knew that beauty and goodness were as fake as the horse, that possibility was the last thing you should ever hope for. I'll just stop there.
Thank you, Mason. Thank you. It's so lovely to hear that after, hear it again after reading through the entire book, to revisit where, how you frame it and where it starts in those opening moments. Is this, how did you know that you wanted to start with, well, actually, was this the first scene that came to you when you were thinking about how Ash will first see Shane?
It was, actually. But I also knew there would be the prologue.
Yes.
And when, you know, when I'm writing, you know, writing about an historical happening that gained national attention, you can't really keep secret the spoilers, right? I can't pretend that we don't know that this is based on someone who was murdered, right? So I just decided to give up the game on that in the prologue and start with the fact of the murder. And what I like about that is, this is a bit of a confession, but I love the movie Titanic. I think I gave that love to my character at one point. He says something about loving, loving the Celine Dion song, My Heart Will Go On.
And he doesn't tell Jenna. He decides not to tell her because he doesn't want to risk.
Yeah, it's the most embarrassing secret he has, is that as a kind of indie rock kid, he loves My Heart Will Go On. But what I love about that movie, actually, is you know what's going to happen from the jump. And the tension of the movie is watching it come towards you. And then maybe even forgetting about it for a little bit. And so I wanted to start with that tragedy, that terrible moment when Shane was murdered, and then let the reader feel it either slip into the background or begin to come toward them ominously. And then I did know that I wanted the first scene, actually, to be Ash seeing Shane for the first time and feeling that kind of charisma and magnetic personality, and being drawn in immediately, because everything I've ever read about Matthew Shepard was that was the effect he had on people. People simply loved him from the first moment. He radiated a kind of kindness and enthusiasm and fun. So I wanted my character to feel that. I wanted my reader to feel that. And I wanted them to be aware that as they were feeling that, they were also in the presence of potential loss.
And that's why you're like, the writing is just a hitch, maybe the tiniest crack, but it was enough to suggest he knew that, right? You're setting these threads in motion.
Yeah. There's another moment in the novel where Shane, after the rehearsal, is on stage by himself, and he starts singing Somewhere from West Side Story. And I wanted that moment in a similar sort of way, because on the one hand, Somewhere is one of those great songs of yearning and optimism, right? It's that sense of, like, somewhere there's a place for us, a time for us. We'll find a new way of living, right? For me, there's always been something wonderfully sort of queer about that yearning, finding a space that's full of possibility. I mean, there's a whole bunch of songs that do that for me, you know, whether it's Somewhere Over the Rainbow from The Wizard of Oz or Moon River. God, Springsteen's Born to Run, Go West by the Village People, then by the Pet Shop Boys, these songs of, like, you know, American yearning, but especially a queer yearning. And so Somewhere is that. And yet, just underneath that, there is this sense of maybe there's not a place for us. Maybe this place we're imagining doesn't really exist and we'll never find it. So I was trying to ride that sort of knife's edge of hope and despair, I think. And Oklahoma did that for me. Oh, what a beautiful morning. But is it really? And that later scene with Somewhere does the same thing.
Yes, it's so haunting because when he finishes singing, even though everyone was stopped and frozen, riveted to it, no one could respond. And in that moment, Shane leaves the stage in a vacuum.
Yeah, and what was hard for me in incorporating these songs as a lover of these songs is, of course, knowing that I can't quote them because of copyright issues, right? So having to paraphrase those lyrics is painful because the paraphrase, you know, doesn't get close to the power of the original. But we were not going to be able to secure permission of the various estates that we needed to be able to quote those. So I did the best I could.
It works. It works, Mason. Let's take a short break and we'll be back today on Living Writers. Mason Stokes joins us via phone. All the Truth I Can Stand, his novel that we're talking about today. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers and we'll be back.
What is love? Baby, don't hurt me. Don't hurt me.
Welcome back. I'm sure everybody out there was dancing. No, I was. Today on Living Writers, Mason Stokes joins us via phone from Saratoga Springs. His book, All the Truth I Can Stand. Mason, thanks for choosing that song. What's the story?
Yeah, so that was a big song for me in my transition from sort of holier-than-thou indie rock kid into someone who could appreciate dance music. You know, as a gay kid growing up in the indie rock scene, it wasn't a very gay scene at the time. Allegedly, I said at some point, someone quoted me on this, that how different my life would have been if I had known that Husker Du was gay and that Depeche Mode wasn't, right? there's a way in which, like, I struggled to find sort of that queer sensibility that was so defined by dance music. And then that song was featured in an episode of My So-Called Life, a great one-season show with a great dance scene involving the character Ricky. And it was my first ability to appreciate sort of four-on-the-floor dance music and not think I'd sold some sort of indie cred in doing so. I've, of course, come to love all dance music, and I've gotten rid of whatever sort of purist sense of what's cool and what isn't, thankfully.
Thankfully, as we all evolve, right?
Sure, right.
Well, thanks for choosing that for today's show. And so let's get back to All the Truth I Can Stand, and maybe connect to Oklahoma again, because it seems such an interesting choice that you bring in to the novel, Mason, where Oklahoma, the actual production of it that's happening in this small town is actually subverting what the town expects the show will be. Were you inspired with the Broadway revival? Is that, that's what you note in the back. I think it was 2019.
Yeah. My partner and I had the good fortune to attend, the new revival of Oklahoma on Broadway in 2019 under the direction of Daniel Fish. And this was a much weirder version of the show. And it was already a weird show to begin with. I mean, Oklahoma is an odd narrative, right? Especially what happens near the end, this sort of wedding that follows, this sort of moment of violence. And Daniel Fish, in directing that show for Broadway, really took some liberties, but I don't even think they're liberties. I think they're in the text with the way that show plays out. And for Fish, even though it's sort of a love triangle between Curly, Judd, and Lori, the real erotic tension is between the two male leads. And in Fish's version of Oklahoma, this musical sort of ends in a kind of bloodbath because of the specter of queer desire. And I just thought that was really interesting, in part because it, of course, I think echoes many of the dynamics of what happened to Matthew Shepard. You know, I had said that his death was as much related to drugs, if not more so, than being gay, but it wasn't totally disconnected from gay male sexuality or from desire. And so I've just always been interested in that violence that lurks underneath the surface of male-male entanglements, whether they be erotic or aggressive. And I just thought it'd be an interesting subplot, a sort of parallel story. What I also remember about that Daniel Fish staging is that the song the show begins with, Oh, What a Beautiful Morning, is reprised at the end of the show. And the actors are covered in blood. And our actor playing Curly is covered in blood while he sings, Oh, What a Beautiful Morning. And that struck me as a really apt image of, I think, everything he was trying to do with the show, but also a lot of what I was trying to do with this book, which is to get beneath the surface of love and desire and violence.
Yes. And also you mentioned, when you say get beneath the surface of love, you also mentioned earlier first love, which I think is so lovely. This is where I see part of the story where your own imagination comes into it, because you create for Ash his first love with Shane, the character that is based on Matthew Shepard. But that you have these wonderful scenes. Like, I'm thinking of, I've got dog-eared many pages, but the one I'm looking at now is 113. And what I've written here, I don't know if you want to... folks listening out there, if you've got a copy already, you can thumb to the page too, or if you want to, Mason. It's when Shane and Ash are driving out of town in Shane's truck. There's different times when the two are able to go somewhere to be together, in nature. Also, which is so striking as this, like, this setting from Wyoming and how Shane was always looking, or at least it's articulated in the book, looking to nature for some kind of healing that he's not able to get from his connections with people or with the drugs, especially meth. But this like going into nature, whether it's the two young men on a sun warmed rock, or if it's here when they're thinking about the prairie, like a bed of soft grass. It's interesting how these moments, you have such an imagined, the empathy for both these characters.
Yeah, that I mean, the nature piece of that comes from, you know, historical detail that Matthew Shepard loved being in nature and loved Wyoming, loved the feeling of the prairie and the wind sweeping across it, loved every bit of it. And I wanted to hang on to that because it was a space for him, some degree of sort of refuge from this other kind of turmoil that he was living in. But I also, I'm flattered to hear you say that you feel empathy here. You know, I certainly, as a person, have a kind of deep respect, and I would even say love for a person I never met, and that's Matthew Shepard. Just in knowing his story, it's hard not to sort of fall into it. But that empathy, I think, comes from one of the weird ironies of being an adult writer of young adult fiction, especially gay young adult fiction, because, you know, people have often remarked how much really sort of good young adult fiction is interested in gay lives, queer lives, lesbian lives. And, you know, sort of a back-of-the-envelope theory about that would be that many of us who grew up gay can still taste the kind of difficulty of that we experienced when we were 14, 15, 16. You know, you'd like to say we've all overcome our traumas and we're completely 100% well-adjusted, healthy people now, but I still know what that first love felt like and what that disappointment felt like, and I know what sort of danger felt like and what self-hatred felt like, and there's a way in which I get to tap into those things as an adult writer of young adult fiction, but it hopefully is all in the interest of empathy. And I did hear from readers last week at this high school event I did, how many of them said some version of, you know, I was so moved by this, I really felt what your characters were feeling. And that was just very gratifying.
Oh, that's
to hear.
High praise indeed, like the best.
Especially from a 14-year-old. 14-year-olds don't go around praising people all the time. So it was nice to hear that from, you know, my actual audience.
Completely better than anything, like better than whatever, like the Publishers Weekly or these other. I mean, not that Publishers Weekly is a bad thing either. I'm just saying that that's what you want, like to know that there's that connection is being made. And as like an older reader, I also feel it. So thank you for writing this, what feels like a really important story right now, especially.
Well, thank you. And I, in terms of young adult versus adult, I do consider young adult fiction to be anyone from about 13 up to about 140. So it's a wide range for me, and I hope, you know, people feel themselves included in it.
Yes. I don't usually ask this, but would you mind reading part of page 113, like I come out here sometimes to clear my head? He said, finally, to the end of the chapter, would you mind?
Happy to. Yeah. So this is a scene where Ash and Shane are, again, as you said, outside of Juniper, which is the town based on Laramie, Wyoming. And it's sort of the day before the premiere of Oklahoma, so it's an important time. And this begins with Shane talking. I come out here sometimes to clear my head, he said finally. It's so quiet here, barren. It's not beautiful, not like Mirror Lake. He squeezed my hand at the memory of the two of us on that warm rock. It's the opposite of beauty, he continued. The whole world is just stripped down. There's nothing but sky. Really, the biggest sky I've ever seen. I think that's what I like about it. The sky is so big that it makes me feel utterly insignificant. I knew what he meant. When Mr. Lindquist talked about the origin of the universe, I felt so small, like I was just a speck in a history that stretched back 14 billion years. In the grand scheme of things, I was no bigger than the subatomic particles that made up every piece of me. You'd think this would be terrifying, but it wasn't. The smallness made me feel safe somehow, like I wasn't alone, and never would be. I want to disappear into a greater whole, Shane said. Not some sort of religious thing, just something larger than myself. Sometimes when I'm here, I think it's just on the verge of happening, and I try to let myself go. But it never happens. I always come back to myself. Just me. Nothing else. We were quiet for a long time after that. I can still feel what it felt like, holding hands under a warm October sun. It was the kind of thing you never want to end, the kind of thing that has to.
Thank you, Mason.
I should tell you, I have to learn just enough about physics to be able to write Ash, because at some point I decided he cared about physics. It was really the only class he liked at school, and so Mr. Lindquist is his physics instructor. And so I read, you know, an introductory book about physics, none of which made any sense to me. I find it imponderably strange. But then I realized Ash doesn't need to understand physics. He just needs to be interested in it. So whatever mistakes I had about it, I could give to him, and it worked out.
And so isn't that, that's so, I love hearing that, Mason, because that's part of the research that you're doing on your characters, for your characters.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, you know, I can understand the basics of Schrodinger's box, you know, the cat that's both alive and dead, but it still doesn't really make sense to me. But I understand a character who'd be fascinated by that. And for Ash, Mr. Lindquist becomes like the only sort of person at the high school who gets it, gets some sense of what Ash is going through. And so it was fun to put my toe in the water of quantum physics and emerge still utterly bemused.
Let's take a short break. Today on Living Writers, Mason Stokes joins us via phone, All the Truth I Can Stand. His young adult novel is out there. It's wonderful. We'll be right back to talk more.
And the sky was made of amethyst, and all the stars were just like little fish. You should learn when to go. You should learn how to say no.
Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today, Mason Stokes joins us via phone, All the Truth I Can Stand, his young adult novel out now. And then that song was awesome. That was so hard also to stop listening to. I feel like that song is for Jenna, the character Jenna.
That is right. I gave Jenna a musical sensibility that I also loved and had. So she was a late 90s kind of you know, grunge, alternative rock, riot girl. And so that song was the great song Violet off Hole's 1995 album, Live Through This. And she and Ash actually sort of bond over some of that stuff. Ash is more of a Husker Du guy, doesn't know the girls as much as Jenna does, but he comes to really appreciate them. And I spent a lot of time with that album, and I was happy to have Jenna do the same.
And was it important, Mason, to have both Jenna and Ash experience great loss, like close family members dying, part of their character building? I didn't phrase that well, but you know what I mean.
I do. No, I get it. And yes, I mean, I knew instantly that Ash had a certain kind of trauma in his recent past, and that was the loss of his mother. And so he's fragile when he meets Shane, and Shane is one of the few people, the only people really, he can talk to about what it feels like to have lost his mother. I'm not going to give away plot details about Jenna, but she is similarly struggling with familial loss. And I just think that becomes the sort of bedrock that they bring to the loss of their friend Shane. And so it's trauma upon trauma. And they're particularly vulnerable, but also particularly eager to sort of try to put the pieces back together. And one way to do that for them is to investigate what happened to their friend. And even if they end up learning stuff they wish they didn't know, it's a part of a healing process for them, both for the loss of Shane, but also for these other people in their life.
And I think it's very interesting to see where when we get in the arc of the novel, when we have another character, Brian, who's a social worker, Well, no, he teaches social work. Gosh, I totally went into character Kevin's perception of him. But he teaches a social work course in Denver. But he's the character that you actually give the title line to. When did you know that Brian was going to be sort of delivering this sort of... Because this is where you're actually... having the characters really face the complexity of like learning more about their friend and love, things that they might have not wanted to know.
Yeah, this was an important chapter for me, and I've been building toward it. It's chapter 22, and it really becomes an argument where Brian, the older professor, is begging Jenna not to publish the story that she has come to know. And Brian is making an argument about it will not be good for the gay community. It will not be good for Shane if you publish this. And he asks Jenna at some point, because Jenna, as a journalist, has said, the truth is what matters to me. And Brian asks her at some point, but is there a line where you would say, no, I'll take this much truth, but not more than that? Is there a line where you would say, I'm sorry, that's all the truth I can stand? And so this becomes an ethical and a journalistic problem for Jenna. Do you run with the story, even if it does real damage? And I enjoyed writing Brian's argument in that scene because, you know, part of me believes it. I had a quote hovering over me for much of my writing of this novel. It's often attributed to Flannery O'Connor, but I think that's apocryphal. It's unclear where it comes from. Hmm. But the quote is, if you have two equally credible yet opposing points of view, then you have a novel. And I wanted that to be the case. And the argument Brian makes not to publish, I understand that. I'm persuaded by it, even as I made other decisions. I won't tell you what my characters ended up doing, but I needed his argument to be persuasive in that moment. And there's a part of me that actually was able to do that because I bought it.
And because I think to write this book, Mason, and to publish it, you needed to write it knowing that Matthew Shepard's family is still, like, they're still out in the world, like people who, or different groups that may want to keep the original story that was told alive.
Right. That was with me the whole time. I was acutely aware that I had a responsibility not only to Matthew Shepard as an historical figure, but I was aware that his parents are still alive and doing really good work on behalf of the Matthew Shepard Foundation. There's a lot of legacy there, and I had to come to terms with what I would feel like writing knowing that Shepard's parents might come across the book and might be really bothered by it. And so I was reading Judy Shepard's memoir, which is a wrenching and beautiful account of the loss of her son. And near the end of that memoir, she complains about the media coverage of her son's murder. And she says the media was trying to make him into an angel, into a kind of martyr figure. And he was far from that, she said. And the real tragedy here wasn't the loss of a perfect human being. It was the loss of a real complicated human being. And she was afraid that the media narrative around this was erasing the complexity and therefore the humanity of her son. So I've got a kind of split sense about this. If she were to read my book, I think she would wish it were not in the world. Quite frankly, they've never accepted the story that involves methamphetamine use here. I understand why they haven't. So on a literal level, I think she would be troubled by the novel. But in writing it, I really do think I was being true to what she said in the memoir, where he worried that the humanity of her son was being stripped away in the process of turning into a symbol. And I hope that what I've done here is not to make him anything other than a victim, but to actually make him more human. And I consider that a kind of an act of love and empathy, even as I'm aware that there will be people for whom this is the wrong book to write at the wrong time.
But this story, this is also using your empathy. That's the power of fiction, like to understand something more.
I hope so. That's what it feels like. That's why it's a pleasure.
And you dedicate the book to Matthew Shepard.
I do. It's dedicated to him, and I would hate for anything in this novel to take away from his legacy, his importance. But I think 25 years after the murder, we are ready as a nation, ready as a queer community, ready as young people to actually look the facts in the face and not need the false solace of some sort of mythologizing. I just don't think that mythologizing serves our community well, nor does it serve this person who led a difficult life and died a tragic death and came to mean a great deal for so many of us. I just think we can let that meaning be as big as it ought to be, which is to say capacious and full of complexity and difficulty.
Mason Stokes, I believe we are ready. So thank you for writing All the Truth I Can Stand. And I hope it's in the hands of many young people of all ages, like you said, like 14 to 114 or so. Thanks so much for talking today with me.
I really appreciate that. It's been a real pleasure. Thanks for your interest and for this conversation. I've enjoyed it.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Mason. Today on Living Writers, Mason Stokes, All the Truth I Can Stand, out with Calkins Creek. Oh, and a thank you to Carrie McManus at Astra Publishing. Thank you to Jason for engineering and making the magic happen as we go out with the use of technology via phone. Thanks to all you out there listening, and All the Truth I Can Stand. I hope you all find it and read it. I'm T. Hetzel. Until next time.
Goodbye, England's rose. May you ever grow in our hearts. You were the grace that placed itself where lives were torn apart. You called out to our country and you whispered to those in pain. Now you belong to heaven and the stars spell out your name. And it seems to me you lived your life like a candle in the wind, never fading with the sunset when the rain set in. And your footsteps will always fall here along England's greenest hills. Your candles burned out long before your legend ever will. Loveliness we've lost, these empty days without your smile. This torch we'll always carry for our nation's golden child. Even though we try, the truth brings us to tears. All our words cannot express the joy you brought us through the years. And it seems to me you lived your life like a candle in the wind, never fading with the sunset when rain set in. Steps will always fall here along England's greenest hills. Your candles burned out long before your legend ever will.
It's 6 o'clock here in Ann Arbor, time for the Daily Sports Report. Good to have you along with me here. My name's Owen Crane alongside TJ Fossmeyer.
Yes,
TJ,
sir.
We're going to have some fun.
Yes, sir.
This is WCBN FM Ann Arbor, 88.3 locally and streaming worldwide on the WCBN app and WCBN.org. There's a lot to talk about today, but we think we'll start things off with a live listen-in. Right now, Michigan baseball is playing Michigan State. The score is 11-3 in the bottom of the fifth inning. So the Spartans with quite the eight-run deficit here. Alex Miller is on the call alongside Tucker Rook. We'll take a quick listen-in and return to you from the studio here in Ann Arbor.
First pitch to McKay, misses inside. One ball, no strikes, nobody gone, two aboard for Ryan McKay. Half swing for McKay. He did not go around, says third base umpire Nathan Thompson.
It didn't look like he necessarily broke his wrist, but looked like he was pretty close.
2-0 to McKay. Two runners on, nobody gone. Here's the 2-0 from Kasner, and he pumps one in on the inner half. 2-1. Good bounce back pitch there.
Really, really key bounce back pitch there. You do not want to lose a guy going down 3-0.